But so this is interesting. Well, first let's do the conclusion. So your conclusion is that this is a man-made virus with an extraordinarily high degree of certainty. You characterize it as a bioweapon. Why do you call it that? In other words, there's the two story. One story is, okay, it's man-made virus, but they made it in order to be, stay a step ahead of nature in case something happens. That's one story. The other story is, this is something that has the intention of being weaponized. So you conclude bioweapon. Why do you conclude that?
Right, because by the definition under the Biological Weapons Convention Treaty, the production of any organism that has no benefit to mankind, that can be harmful to mankind, is a bioweapon. So this is way beyond, all these inserts are way beyond anything that could potentially be used for peaceful or beneficial purposes. And then when you look at the vaccine, you really have to say, well, what's in the vaccines? There's lots of variants to any virus that exists. So the original virus is called SARS-CoV-2 Wuhan HU1. That's the original virus. And so they took the genetic code sequence of that for the spike protein, and that's what is in the vaccines. So if that, by definition, is a bioweapon, then the replication of that in the vaccines is a bioweapon. You know, it's not a bioweapon in one instance, but not in another.
Right.
And the problem with doing that approach is that it's completely different than what we've ever done before. And in the past, we've always taken, whether you like vaccines or not, I'm not anti-vaccine, I'm just anti-bad medicine, I'm anti-stupid. If you look at what we've done before, we've taken all the viruses, all the variants, and all the parts, all right? And we've weakened them, that's called attenuation, and we've injected it into people so they make an immune response. And then we measure that immune response, you know, the T cells and the antibodies, and we know we have an immune response. And one question for your listeners to do is to go to FlemingMethod.com, go to the EUA documents, and you'll find none of that data is in the EUA documents, the emergency use authorization documents. In other words, there's no data that the companies are proving that they're developing or generating an immune response.
Right.
And in fact, if you read through the EUAs thoroughly and you do the statistical analysis of the data, you'll find out there's not a statistical reduction in COVID cases using the vaccines either, or a statistical reduction in deaths. So they took HU1 spike protein, and that's what's being injected into people, or something fairly close to that.
Well, can I
Now,
ask a question? Just a
sure.
clarifying question. Is it that they are injecting the spike protein or they're injecting the mRNA that causes your body to create the spike protein?
Right. So Pfizer and Moderna are injecting the mRNA, AstraZeneca and Janssen, which most people call Johnson and Johnson, but the company's Janssen. I have double-stranded DNA. So they're injecting the genetic sequence to get the cell to make the spike protein. And we already know that, I mean, again, 2017 was a big year for all of this, that in 2017, Moderna did a study with a lipid nanoparticle for influenza virus using mRNA. And when they did that study, they showed that the lipid nanoparticle went all over the body. It didn't stay at the injection site. It went to the brain, the bone marrow, the liver, the spleen, the heart, you name it. And it did it relatively rapidly. So when everybody says, gosh, we didn't know it would spread, I'm sorry, Moderna published a paper in 2017 that said it does. So, you know, I'm just a dumb nuclear cardiologist. So, yeah, I mean, I sometimes follow that up with the guy who developed the theory and the patent, but still just a dumb nuclear cardiologist, right?
Yeah, so the implications that I think are kind of important, saying that the safety, I guess the proposed theory around the safety of the vaccine was, hey, this is going to stay local. It's going to mount an immune response based on a controllable amount of these spike proteins being evoked from the body, and then your body will mount the immune response. And I always wondered how they know how controlled that can possibly be. But the whole premise was predicated on it staying kind of local to the injection site. At this point, we know that it goes through the whole body, and you're saying there were papers cited from one of the vaccine manufacturers, Moderna, that showed that this actually goes on. So now the question, if the FDA was made aware that this was likely going to go systemic as compared to local, do you think they would have given it emergency use authorization?
Well, to begin with, the FDA's job is to fully evaluate a drug. And if you're sitting there on the panel and you're supposed to evaluate this, you ought to do a little bit of research. Mm-hmm. And it's clear to me that they didn't. In fact, if you look at the FDA's track record, they've pulled off twice as many drugs in recent years as they approved. Now, the only reason for having to pull them is, oops, I guess we shouldn't have approved that, right? So that doesn't speak well of the agency, right? I mean, if you're throwing stuff out and you have to take back twice as much every year, maybe you better do a better job, right? just my thought. I mean, I've had my go rounds with them over the years, and you know, I've tried to explain these nuclear imaging isotopes and the fact that Big Pharma is selling twice as much of these isotopes and overexposing people to radiation. And the response I got from the FDA was, well, we need more cardiac cath data, you know, injecting the arteries of the heart. And I said, no, we don't. I've provided you quantitative data. And they said, well, no, we need more. And I said, based upon what? And they said, based upon the experts. And I said, well, there's only five people who've written major papers on this: Dietrich, Zur, De Bruin, Bowman, and Fleming. Mm-hmm. And Dietrich, Zur, De Bruin, and Bowman don't work at the FDA, and I certainly don't. So I don't know who your experts are, but they're not the experts. They're not the people that have written the landmark papers. They don't positively impress me. I mean, I get that question with, okay, so they're EUA vaccines. What if the FDA approves it? Well, what if they do? You know, because with their track record, it doesn't give me a lot of confidence.
Well, let me ask you this question. You know, based on your research background and having a deep understanding of literally, you know, that is relevant to this whole COVID vaccine program and the mechanisms of actions of the COVID vaccine, et cetera, is that, can you, because this is, you started to talk about how traditionally viruses, you know, vaccines are attenuated viruses, you know, that amount of certain immune response, et cetera, et cetera. This clearly is, do you agree with the statement that this is clearly gene therapy, not, you know, vaccines as we traditionally understand them?
Well, I think the answer to that question is what the FDA and Health and Human Services says this is, okay? And they have published two papers, again, one in 2017 and another one in 2020. And they are papers that are guidance to the industry of mRNA, gene therapy, drug vaccines. Okay, that's the title of the 2017 paper. And then the 2020 paper said, had to do with shedding, and shedding is defined as the product of the vector. Well, the vector is how you get it into the body, you know, the lipid nanoparticle or the adenovirus or whatever. And the vector would be the spike protein. Mm-hmm. So it's not like they're coming out and saying the spike protein is shedding. But in both papers, the FDA Health and Human Services defines shedding and gene therapy. So you don't even have to ask what I think, that FDA and Health and Human Services has defined it for everybody.
So now, given that, it's kind of startling, you know, that this is all hiding in plain sight, right? And people, it's just a matter of somebody taking the time to connect all these dots like you have, and knowing how to read the research and kind of contextualize it to what's going on right now. But now, given that, what is within the academic and scientific community kind of the standard for safety testing for gene therapy?
I don't think we have a safety testing method for gene therapy because, you know, for example, CRISPR technology, which is related to a lot of this, is kind of a shotgun approach. I don't, you know, you only have four nucleotide bases for DNA and four for RNA. And there's only so many combinations of those four you can put together. And CRISPR just simply says, let's go find this sequence, right? So it's going to just get into the cells and look for those sequences. Now, it just because the premise is it's going after a bad gene area doesn't mean that that's the only place that sequence is at. That sequence, by the way, could be in something that's vital to human survival. Mm-hmm. We don't know. We don't know. So we're shotgunning it, okay? And that's kind of what's happening with a lot of these treatments. I mean, this is kind of like Jurassic Park, if you think about it. We have a bunch of people that are playing with science that they didn't build, that I don't personally think they have the intellectual capability of really understanding or the ethical integrity to do it. in the way that it needs to be, but they've got a toy, and you know, it's like Jurassic Park. And I find that personally concerning because I it's kind of like one of my initial comments was I got to do things beginning in that seventh grade of my life with physics that I wouldn't in my wildest imagination, I wouldn't let most doctoral students do today. Okay. Wow. Just simply because of what it is. So these folks are playing around with something that's above their pay grade, as far as I'm concerned. And the results have been devastating. I think part of this, they had no idea what they're doing. And as they're stumbling around in the dark, they're developing these problems. And then they want to, of course, see what these problems do. And so it's the combination of stumbling into things and then going, oh, wow, what do we have now? Let's play with this and see what this does. Well, playing with this and seeing what it does has some really devastating effects. What I started to mention about the spike protein is that what we're seeing is what's called pressure selection with these variants. So as an example for the people watching, most people have heard about antibiotic-resistant bacteria, bacteria that you can give somebody an antibiotic and it won't have any effect. The bacteria is resistant. Well, if you take, for example, Escherichia coli, which is a bacteria that resides in most people's colons. Mm-hmm. Much of that E. coli isn't resistant to bacteria, but some are. Mm-hmm. And some are resistant to one type of antibiotic, some are resistant to a different type. So if you have a problem and you put antibiotics into somebody, it'll kill the ones that that don't have resistance, right? But it will leave the ones that do. So those will flourish, and they will become the primary flora, as they're called. And the way you treat that is you actually pull back the antibiotics and encourage the ones that are not resistant to thrive again, okay? Now, what we've done with this approach to vaccines targeting HU1 spike protein is they have obviously developed an immune response, although it's an impaired immune response. If you look at the data, it interferes with interferon, it interferes with T helper 2 cells, which produces problems and resets the adaptive immune system. But what it does, so when it takes out the HU1 component, you see spike proteins, viruses that are far enough away from the HU1 spike protein virus that they can survive. Well, when did we first see that? We first saw that last year with the Alpha variant in the UK, right? Everybody's kind of forgotten about that now with Delta, but it was the Alpha variant. And then the Beta variant came up. And then, you know, we had multiple variants that the further, and you can track this, and that's how I know, because I'm keeping track with the people that are actually doing this genotype sequencing of these variants and these viruses to know what's really going on. And that tells you, and I've exposed and shown in some of my presentations, that what's happened is that as we've given each successive vaccine, you can see that not only does it not decrease the number of SARS-CoV-2 cases in the world, in any country, but it has shifted away from the HU1 and the Alpha and the Beta to the Delta and the Lambda and the Mu, the ones that are further away. So we have pressure selected. We put pressure on the virus to select the viruses that are more dissimilar from the HU1. That's, we've done a great job of curbing that. Adding the boosters doesn't change that. It just encourages more pressure selection. I know I shouldn't laugh because, it's a concern. But my laughter is not at the people concerned about it, but the people doing it. It shows that they don't understand what they're doing. And that's sad. And so the reason for saying that the way we treat antibiotic-resistant bacteria problems is to pull off the antibiotics, what that tells us is that the way to address this is to pull back the drug vaccines, to stop pressure selecting so that the HU1 and the others will come back into balance, and all this natural immunity that people are developing from person-to-person transfer will catch up. In fact, there was a paper that was published not 3 or 4 days ago that shows Again, I talked about all the parts. So coronaviruses have spike protein, they have hemagglutinin, they have envelope, they have membrane. It turns out that it's the membrane antigen that we as humans make our best antibody response to. So the part of the virus that we're best at recognizing and attacking to defend ourselves isn't even in the vaccines.